and welcome to the NJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell and I am the journal's news and online editor. Today our topic is glaucoma, the world's leading cause of irreversible blindness. In Australia, about 3% of the population is estimated to have glaucoma, with about half of them unaware that they have the disease. A new narrative review published by the NJA looks at current management of glaucoma and where the big breakthroughs in treatment are likely to come. Dr. Jed Lusthaus is an ophthalmologist and staff specialist at Sydney Eye Hospital and the University of Sydney. He is co-author of the review and he is my special guest today. What is glaucoma and what causes it?
The term glaucoma refers to a group of diseases, and this group of diseases cause damage to the optic nerve, so an optic neuropathy. And we don't really understand how most people get glaucoma. Similarly to systemic hypertension, where you have primary and secondary causes, we don't understand very well why people get primary open-angle glaucoma, but we do have a great understanding if it's a secondary cause. So in terms of primary open-angle glaucoma, we think that there's probably a build-up of debris in the drainage system of the eye, and over a long period of time, I'm talking years and decades, this can cause problems with the pressure. But there are other mechanisms at play as well, aside from the pressure side of things, and those are related to vascular risks. So you can have damage from glaucoma due to pressure, or you can have damage due to blood flow problems as well. And this is something that's becoming more prominent in people's minds these days when we're looking at patients with glaucoma.
What is the difference between open angle and closed angle glaucoma? I guess I'm asking what angle we're talking about.
The eye produces fluid constantly to maintain pressure and maintain its optical and refractive powers. And in order to maintain that pressure, it also has to drain fluid out, otherwise it will overflow. That will affect the functioning of the eye. So the drainage angle is a part of the eye, which is actually where the iris joins to the cornea. So the iris is the coloured part, the cornea is the front clear window. So where they meet, there's it's called an angle because when you look at it in cross-section, it looks like a geometric angle.
Okay.
At that position, that's where the fluid drains out, and it drains through a structure called the trabecular meshwork, and then that drains into a small canal called the canal of Schlemm. So that's what we're referring to with the regular drainage system. When we talk about open-angle glaucoma, that drainage angle appears to look like it's patent when you look at it with a special mirrored lens, as opposed to closed-angle glaucoma, where there is a physical obstruction to the drainage system. So that obstruction can be related to usually the peripheral iris coming up and sticking onto the drainage angle, or it could be other things like an inflammatory membrane or even some neoplastic or malignant process as well.
What is the prevalence of glaucoma in Australia?
So we think it's approximately 3% of Australians who have glaucoma. And the reason why I say think is because we're missing half of patients who have glaucoma. They remain undiagnosed because it's such a silent disease. Patients don't realise that they have the condition until it's in its very late stages.
Right.
It affects the peripheral vision, the outside vision, and it takes many years in most cases to start affecting patients' central vision. So people don't present with symptoms of glaucoma unless it's an acute angle closure type. They tend to be picked up by optometrists, or they know that they've got a family history and they're picked up incidentally. So we're missing a huge number of patients in Australia and in the world with glaucoma, and that's one of the challenges of the disease. It's the most common irreversible cause of blindness in the world, so it's a very important disease.
What does an acute presentation of glaucoma look like or feel like?
So an acute presentation is very different from a chronic open-angle glaucoma presentation. So the acute presentations, kind of like in orthopedic terms, like a compartment syndrome of the eye, a big build-up of pressure within the eye due to a complete blockage of the drainage system.
Mm-hmm.
So these patients have very painful and red eyes, eyes often swollen. Their vision becomes blurred because the cornea, the front window, can't take the extra pressure in the eye, and it starts to become cloudy. This is a temporary change. So these patients do present with a lot of symptoms, and they often present to the emergency department because they're that unwell. The pressure can make them feel nauseous or even vomit. But these conditions, even though they're presenting with high pain and often blurred vision and feeling unwell, they can sometimes be confused for neurological conditions such as, you know, stroke or migraine. So there are some findings within the eye that we look for, such as a pupil that is mid-dilated and not responding, and the vision being reduced. So those things we look for, and that might suggest that there is an acute angle closure glaucoma rather than a neurological process.
So what's the gold standard treatment for glaucoma?
So the only proven treatment that we know of is to lower the eye pressure, the intraocular pressure. And there have been many, many studies demonstrating the effect of reducing eye pressure and the benefit in doing so to slow or halt the damage from glaucoma. So glaucoma that's damaged cannot be reversed. It can only be slowed to a point where it's not continuing to cause damage. The gold standard, as I said, is to reduce the eye pressure, and we do that with either eye drops or laser procedures or surgery. Mm-hmm. So most patients will start off with eye drop therapy, and there are multiple different types of eye drops that can be used. And then the second option may be laser treatment called selective laser trabeculoplasty. But these days it's becoming a bit more mainstream, so some people are using this as a first-line treatment. And then surgery is generally left for a little bit later in the treatment algorithm.
Eye drops sounds very easy. Is compliance good?
So compliance, I'm laughing because it's one of the most difficult parts of my job is trying to maintain treatment adherence for patients. And the reason for that is, that, as I mentioned before, this is an asymptomatic condition in most cases. So people get told, you've got glaucoma, you need to take these drops, but they don't feel any symptoms. Mm-hmm. And the drops themselves can cause symptoms. So the drops can cause redness of their eyes, and can cause stinging, they can cause blurred vision, dry eye, irritation, lots of different symptoms. And patients think that, you know, they're causing a lot of trouble, maybe they're not helping, so they just stop them. It was interesting, there was a study that looked at patient compliance to treatment, and the patients knew that they were being monitored in terms of whether they were taking the drops or not, and still 45 to 50% of these patients didn't take their treatment even though they knew they were being monitored. So it's a really significant problem and one of the biggest challenges for glaucoma specialists.
Are eye drops improving? Are there new eye drops coming up that are less side effect heavy?
We've actually not had any new eye drop groups or agents for about 20 years. So the most recent addition was the group called the prostaglandin analogs, and they're now the mainstay of, or the first treatment option because they've got the best safety profile. And there have been improvements to those drops. So we've had some over the last 20 years. It's not like nothing's happened. We have had the advent of preservative-free options, which can be more comfortable for patients and reduce the ocular surface-related side effects such as dry eye and irritation, redness. There's also been fixed combination drops that have come in. So instead of being on one bottle for each drop, now you can have two drops within the one bottle. That can reduce the amount of preservative going onto the eye and also improve compliance rates. Patients don't need to take as many drops. So there have been some improvements in the drops, but we're only now seeing new groups of agents coming through, and there have been two that have been approved by the FDA in the States, and hopefully we'll be seeing them in Australia shortly, because they have the ability to reduce intraocular pressure in a different way. One of them is in a group called the Rho kinase inhibitors, and that is a mechanism that reduces intraocular pressure by improving the natural drainage outflow through the trabecular meshwork. And at this point in time, we don't have any agents that do that, an exciting option. Then there's another one, which is a combination of a prostaglandin analog combined with a nitric oxide donating mechanism to have the effect of the prostaglandin analog and also the effect of the nitric oxide donation to improve flow through the conventional system. So these are exciting medications coming through, and hopefully they'll be on our shores in the near future.
I'm chatting today with Dr. Jed Lusthaus, an ophthalmologist at Sydney Eye Hospital. His co-authored narrative, Review, can be found at mja.com.au. Back to our chat. Let's talk a little bit about laser therapy. What are the two different types of laser therapy and which one is gaining the ascendancy, if anything?
Traditionally, argon laser trabeculoplasty was the laser treatment that was being used, but that's really been superseded by selective laser trabeculoplasty. And the difference is that the argon laser, or the ALT, is much more destructive, right, and it causes more chance of scar tissue in the drainage system, whereas the selective laser trabeculoplasty, SLT, is more gentle. It tends to remodel the trabecular meshwork to improve outflow. So it's kind of like cleaning the drain pipe, whereas ALT is bursting holes through the drain pipe.
Right.
So SLT is a treatment that is repeatable. It's really quite comfortable for the patients to have compared to ALT, which is a bit more uncomfortable.
Yep.
And it's quite straightforward to perform. So it has really taken off as the primary laser treatment to be performed in the office, as I've just mentioned, SLT. Mm-hmm. And that's done in the office. The other is called cyclodiode laser, and that's a whole different treatment option. And even though it's laser, it's focused on a different part of the eye, and that needs to be performed in the operating theatre because the patient needs an anaesthetic block.
At what point does surgery become the best option, and what does that surgery involve exactly?
Surgery is becoming a little bit more common earlier in the treatment ladder, and that's because we're seeing a shift to options that are safer than the traditional options. So up to recently, we've had mainly trabeculectomy surgery, which is the traditional and gold standard glaucoma surgery. Essentially, it's creating a fistula between the anterior chamber and the space under the conjunctiva, which is the top layer of the white part of your eye.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's creating a little reservoir for fluid to drain out. And that's been the gold standard and still is the gold standard to this date. But it has a number of risk factors that mean that we're looking for safer and more predictable options.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a multitude of little stents coming through over the last few years. And these are referred to as MIGS devices, minimally invasive glaucoma surgery devices. And there's a whole range of these. In Australia, we have four devices that are approved for use. And they have different mechanisms that are inserted in different parts of the eye to direct fluid into different places. So it's very exciting that these have come through. And we're still working out exactly where they fit into the treatment paradigm,
yeah,
and very much a work in progress, but it's exciting to see safer options coming through.
How small are these things, these stents?
So one of them, the eye stent, is actually the smallest implant that you can put in the body, and it's microscopic. It looks like a speck of dust
to
the naked eye, and it's threaded through the trabecular meshwork to sit with its head in the anterior chamber, and then it has the rest of its body in Schlemm's canal. So it's tapping into the conventional or physiological drainage outflow system to try and reinvigorate that system. And it's a very safe device, but with all of these, there's always a but and a downside. The pressures are probably not as low as you would need it for some patient groups.
Right.
And
yeah.
So that's when we're looking at, again, trabeculectomy being such a reliable and known entity. We know that we can get the pressure really low with trabeculectomy. So there are definitely many cases that still require the traditional surgery. So that's the eye stent. Then there are other devices. So there's a device called the Zen Gel Stent.
Mm-hmm.
And that is essentially a small stent that is trying to create a faster trabeculectomy. So again, it connects the anterior chamber and it threads through to under the subconjunctival space, and it creates a bleb or a drainage reservoir similar to a trabeculectomy, but it only takes about 10 minutes as opposed to approximately an hour with trabeculectomy surgery. It's done ab interno, so from within the eye, and the safety profile is much better than trabeculectomy. But again, there's issues with healing and scar tissue formation, which is an issue with trabeculectomy surgery as well. But we're just still trying to find the right formula to combat this at the moment.
Have these small devices changed practice in terms of surgical technique?
Yeah, I think we're becoming more proficient in not only assessing the drainage angle, but also operating on the drainage angle. And these are skills that we're picking up as things progress with these stents, and improving our techniques and trying to get the best results out of these stents. And there is definitely a process of adjustment and refining techniques. There have been new lenses coming onto the market to try and visualize the angle better. Lots of new stents that are coming through in the future as well. Look, there are many options coming through, and it's just about trying to work out what is the best option for the patient. So the surgical consultation now is a lot more complicated than it used to be. So it's a matter of trying to manage the risk profile of the patient and trying to get the appropriate pressure as well. Some people don't need a really low pressure, so the stents are more appropriate for them, whereas other people need a pressure less than 10, and a trabeculectomy is probably the only thing that will do that reliably.
What's coming on the horizon? What are the hopes that research is promising?
As we mentioned before, treatment adherence is a major issue in glaucoma, and there are a number of exciting options to try and improve adherence to treatment, and these are focused on removing, I guess, the patient as the person that's relied upon to deliver the treatment and putting it back in the hands of the clinician. So there are a number of options coming through for drug eluting mechanisms. So there are a number of devices in trial, for example, little plugs that go into the punctum or the tear duct to gradually release medication, or ocular ring inserts, so a ring that is inserted onto the surface of the eye and sits behind the eyelids, and that gradually releases medication. Similarly, there are injection or injectable implants that can be injected into the subconjunctival space or even into the anterior chamber, and these gradually release medication. And particularly in the instance of the devices inserted into the anterior chamber, those medications are designed to delivering the drug closer to the receptors, and that will reduce the concentration of drug required to have the desired effect, and it will also reduce the side effects profile of the medication. So these options are all in phase 1 to 2 studies at the moment, and hopefully we'll see them coming through. And there's still, particularly in glaucoma, there's still a lot we don't know about why people have certain types of eye pressure problems, or why people have glaucoma progressing when their pressure seems to be within a very low range. Okay. So again, that refers back to those patients who might have problems with vascular flow or vascular risk factors that might also be causing glaucoma.
Does diabetes have a role in glaucoma?
Yeah, so diabetes is a risk factor for glaucoma, and it's a risk factor for a number of eye diseases, but it is definitely something that's associated with glaucoma, and something that we do like to try and keep under control. And it's important also to work with physicians and GPs to try and maintain control of diabetes, because not only can it cause or be a risk for glaucoma, it can also be a risk for other eye conditions.
One of the themes of your paper was early intervention and early detection. What role do GPs play in that?
So I think it's really critical having GPs on board with glaucoma, because they're in a position to ask the questions. These are patients that we don't have contact with, and they can, if the patient mentions that they have a history of glaucoma, then it would be really important for the GP to say, well, have you had your eyes checked? to make sure that you're not at risk. And it's as simple as going to referring them to the optometrist, and the optometrist can assess them. And then so they can pick up somebody who may have been missed and then might lose significant vision in the future. Mm-hmm. They're also really critical for encouraging and maintaining treatment adherence. That could be simply through providing repeat prescriptions if the patients are running out, because it's not uncommon that patients will run out of their medication and think, oh, I'll get that in 2 months when I go back to the eye doctor. But that's 2 months of untreated glaucoma that could be avoided. So keeping on top of whether up to the prescriptions is also very helpful. And also managing their systemic risk factors. So I alluded to vascular risk factors before, and things like obstructive sleep apnea, diabetes, systemic hypertension, these are all risk factors for glaucoma. And if they're controlled, it can really improve patient outcomes and help to control their glaucoma.
How important are advocacy groups, Jed?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really critical part of glaucoma management, because glaucoma is a really complicated disease, and it's really helpful to have patient advocacy groups to be an extra support. And groups like Glaucoma Australia do a fantastic job to support patients and give them resources and even give them explanations how to put their drops in and lots of other advice. So it's really fantastic to have support from those bodies. Glaucoma Australia specifically does a fantastic job. They manage to support patients. They're also building databases. They're helping out with research as well into glaucoma. And, yeah, I think they do a really fantastic job.
Thank you for your time, Jed.
Thanks. No problem at all.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.